Welcome to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast with your hosts, Richard Hill and Matthew Darlitz.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. My name is Matthew Darlitz from the Science of Psychotherapy, and I'm here with my good friend and co-creator of the Science of Psychotherapy, Richard Hill. How are you, Richard?
I'm really good, thank you, Matthew. Yes, it's beautiful. Now we're the Science of Psychotherapy online program, and we're the Science of Psychotherapy magazine, of which I'm the managing editor. Please send me your articles and your information. We'll put it in the magazine. We'll put it into our blog. Let us be a part of your mouthpiece out into the world. But today, we're in part two. We do this every now and again when something's really interesting. But we had this conversation last week about PANS and PANDAS. Matt, it was just so fascinating. Mm-hmm. But we need to get down to some nitty gritty and some sort of pragmatic functional things to do. And that's what we're going to do this week with Michaela.
That's right. So we're going to revisit Michaela Monterio-Haig. She is a naturopath and she's an expert in mental health as it pertains to naturopathy. And she's a very clever woman. And so we want to pick her brains about, as psychotherapists, you know, what should we know about and what should we be doing when we suspect that some of the things that are, some of the symptoms that we're seeing in front of us with our clients could have a neurobiological underpinning.
Yeah, I'm really impressed with the amount of stuff that Michaela seeks to learn outside of what would be her sort of, the silo that the category of naturopathy would fit into. She doesn't truck with just studying what she's told. She's out there learning everything, and smart woman. Let's talk to her.
Michaela, hi, welcome back to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. Last week we were talking about PANDAS and PANS, and so we sort of very quickly got up to our half hour point. So we thought we'd cut it off there, and we'll get back this week. So welcome back.
Thank you for having me back again.
And what I thought would be really cool is let's talk about some really pragmatic things that therapists need to know about and do when they come across clients that have some of these constellation of symptoms. Now, we might just recap slightly what we're talking about here. So we've been talking about this pediatric autoimmune disorder. It's we've described it as a basal ganglia, like autoencephalitis. It's an inflammation of the central nervous system because we've had this assault by autoantibodies, antibodies developed to fight an infection, for example, but it's attacking our own nervous system. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're not familiar with it, go back, listen to last week's podcast. We'll be able to fill you in there. But now we're therapists, we're sitting with somebody, they've got OCD, they're not sleeping, they're wetting the bed, you know, they've got all of these things, and these things just seem to have come on suddenly. Mm. Parents are at a loss. We've maybe tried to increase serotonin levels, maybe not working so well. What are we thinking? What can we do?
Mm. So as therapists, I guess as a naturopath, I always look at not just the biology of things, which I'm really interested in, but also what emotional issues could be going on. So for almost just about any patient that I see, I will refer to see a counselor, because undoubtedly there's always some trauma, something happened along the way that has led them to be, suffering from a physical ailment. So I always look at in a holistic model. So I would ask, I guess, for therapists to also look how they practice in a holistic way. So obviously look at the emotional components, the psychosocial components, but then I think it's important to always have in the back of the mind what biological factors could be at play, you know, because we're not just a body, everything is connected. So there is going to be, even if it's just diet, you know, or sleep, there's always something physical also at play. So, and I guess as practitioners, it's important to have a network of other practitioners you can refer on. So I refer to counsellors or psychologists, so therapists, if they have know of a good GP or integrative a doctor, naturopath or nutritionist who they can refer on to then look at what biological drivers could be, you know, having a play in this manifestation.
Yeah, yeah, beautiful. Now, I've had clients myself that I've referred to you, and they've come back to me and they've said, well, there was, you know, something missing here and I need to supplement something there, and now that anxiety has been greatly reduced. Now, we might still have some things to work on in terms of, you know, relationships and maybe attachment styles.
Yeah.
But I'm confident then that we've dealt with any biological, you know, underpinnings that might be going on, something that we can, you know, we could sort out all sorts of things to do with attachment style. But if there's a biological driver which is causing anxiety, even something as simple as you've talked about in the past with us as dehydration.
Yes, yes, yeah.
You know, if we know, if as a psychotherapist, I know if I've got those things covered, then you know, we can then move with confidence to say, well, okay, if there's any more anxiety, probably a psychological thing then that we need to be touching.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And when we look at, I mean, we talk a lot about complex system, the complex system of the body. And of course, that's what we're talking about here when we're saying you need to look at the psychology, the biology, the emotional state, the historic references and frameworks. There's also a relevance in a complex system to, and using very unscientific terminology, but there are some elements that have more heat than others, that have more proximity and more contextual relationship, that are the better ones to poke. And so it's exactly the thing. As we know, sometimes you can just poke the hydration of somebody and you can completely resolve a whole bunch of issues along the track. And as we know, in older patients, if we just look at the salt levels, so it's, I don't think it's saying that you do this and that's the cause and so therefore you have the effect, but that's, so there's proximal ones to treat. And this is our difficulty as practitioners, and that use of engaging other people's brains. Because, I mean, I love naturopathy, but there's no way I can learn it all. I was greatly fortunate to marry a body worker who knows everything about and who's a lifestyle specialist. So it was really cool. But these broader things that Matt's talking about there and you're talking about there, I just go, that's where we have to see it, but not looking for cause and effect so directly as the whole system interplaying and interacting and affecting each other. It's a really wonderful way to work. I love listening to you talk about it.
This comes back to what John Arden was saying to us as well. You know, to be contemporary therapists, we have to know about, you know, exercise and diet and all of these things, but we don't have to be, you know, the exercise physiologist and the naturopath, but we have to have these people around about us that we can refer to.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Across the synapse, as Luke Cozzolino talks about, and he writes about that in the June issue, where we had the where to now, and so he also was talking about. In fact, quite a few of the people in the where to now articles who wrote and, you know, talked in that vein. But sorry, Michaela, we're getting back to you. We're getting away from you. This is so fascinating. My God,
if I can bring it back to pans and pandas. So if I've got a client that I'm sort of, you know, some light bulb moments are going off for me. I'm saying, oh, there's this constellation of things happening. Maybe I remember hearing, you know, someone on a podcast talk about this thing called Pans Pandas. Maybe it's something to do with. So I refer them to you, Michaela. What would you be looking at? What do you do?
So I would take it a case history, and it's important, I think, to mention that this can happen with adults as well. So not just children. So pandas is, as part of the criteria, yes, a pediatric, you know, infers it's in children. However, I have seen it in adults as well. So pans can occur in adults, especially if it's after an infection and you start to see some psychological issues. So, it can affect children, certainly, but this can also affect adults. So I want therapists to just be aware of that as well, that adults are very much impacted by this. So what I would do is take a case history. I usually run some blood tests. I do some investigative tests. I can refer to their GP for blood tests, or they can do it straight through me. But usually with a case history, a good thorough case history and some pathology workup, I can sort of figure out where things may be lying, you know, what might be the issue. And then I can refer to a GP or to a specialist, or if it's something that I feel like, you know, it's within my scope of practice and I can treat them myself. But yeah, usually it's a team effort. Yeah.
Okay. Now, specifically for this this autoimmune disorder that happens, anyone that does any sort of, you know, research into this will come across the Cunningham panel.
Yes.
So what is that about?
So the Cunningham panel is a test that was devised in the US by Dr. Cunningham, and it tests for neuronal antigens. So it's the anti-dopamine receptor 1, anti-dopamine receptor 2. There's another one, anti-lysoganglioside and anti-tubulin antigens. Just all big words, just to say there is a specific test that tests for these antigens that if they test positive, that is, you know, a likely confirmation of something like PANDAS and PAN. So that test was devised in the US, and only up until recently it wasn't available in Australia. However, it is available now through a particular lab that naturopaths have access to. So I have access to that lab, Naturopath. Some integrative doctors would also have access to that. GPs wouldn't know about it. So they wouldn't know about that particular test. They wouldn't know that it's available in Australia. So I would go to either a naturopath or an integrative GP and ask for the Cunningham panel through Naturopath Labs. So we give you a referral for that, and then you get sent a kit and, you know, with instructions on how to do that. So that's the big test that will basically say, yes, this is the confirmation of PANDAS or PANS. Before that, what we used to do is test for antibodies, the strep ASO titers, and that's done through a GP, although oftentimes it comes back as a false negative because they're not taking the swabs properly. It's got to be taken properly in the nose and throat and other areas of the body. So and that's got to be repeated 2 weeks after that to make sure, you know, that's confirmed. And then going with clinical history, you can sort of gauge that's a likely diagnosis. But now with the Cunningham panel available, that certainly makes it easier for patients and naturopaths and integrative GPs too.
So it sounds like the key is getting the right professional who knows about this panel.
Yes.
And so the panel also, it's only a snapshot, isn't it, in the moment. So that can change depending on if there's a flare-up.
Correct. Yes, because PANDAS and PANS are remitting, and, you know, it's a flare-up and then relapse and remitting disease. So there is a pattern to it where there will be a flare-up and then you'll be okay for a little bit and then you get another flare-up. So I guess it's catching, you know, during the flare-up stage, if that's happening there. Yeah.
It's both interesting and a little disturbing to me, because strep, certainly staph to a little less extent, are actually quite prevalent in the environment. I know when I got my strep infection, I said, "Where did it come from?" He said, "Oh, just a break in the skin." And we're quite successfully dealing with these issues all the time. So for kids, of course, I guess this is why it's more prevalent in children, because we're less geared up to deal with these generally prevalent strep and staph infections, you know, bugs that are around. I mean, there's bugs all over the place, and we deal with them quite successfully all the time. So That's another story, I suppose. We won't discuss it now. The resistance of the medical profession to take this on board, but you know, I do sympathise with them. There's a hell of a lot to know, and this is a newer understanding. And anyway, it's great we're talking about it. So again, I'll hand back to you just with that comment.
Yeah, it's just that the with strep, the fact that it's a mimicry of certain aspects of the receptors and you know other parts of our neural system, it just by happen chance it looks the same. So the key fits.
That's right. That's how a lot of autoimmune diseases occur. It's that molecular mimicry of an antigen very similar to your own tissue in the body, and depending on what that is, you know, it could be Graves' disease or Hashimoto's or rheumatoid arthritis or ankylosing spondylitis. It can be, yeah. The molecular mimicry is definitely a big factor in developing that.
So is there an individual inclination or greater an individual thing, or is it just bad luck, or is it a combination of the two? Some people are more likely to than others, or any idea on that knowledge? That might be too difficult, you know, too unknown a question.
It's definitely a combination. It's almost like a perfect storm. So there are genetic factors, certainly, in developing an autoimmune disease. But there's also other things like where your immune system's at, so inflammation, how your gut microbiome is behaving,
yes.
You know, how much stress you're under as well. So there's usually it's not just one factor. It's a combination of factors creating this perfect storm.
Mm. Could you just talk a little bit more about the gut factor, you know, especially in terms of leaky gut and, you know, priming the immune system for leading up to this perfect storm?
Yeah, so for a number of reasons that affect the gut to not work as well. So, for example, stress, whether that's emotional stress or physical stress from an infection, you know, like a parasite or something like that, that will cause damage to the gut lining or even affect the balance of the gut flora that you have in your gut. Now, the gut flora, one of its jobs is to keep the gut integrity or gut lining tight so that we don't get pathogens and proteins going from the gut to the blood. So it's meant to be tight. When there's an imbalance in gut flora or if there's been injury to the gut by a parasite, what happens is, you know, the gut lining starts to not be as tight as it should be, and that's where the term leaky gut comes in. So the tight junctions between cells are no longer tight, they're damaged. So then that's when you get things like proteins from food or pathogens that start to enter the bloodstream, you know, circulate in the bloodstream, and that's when you get an immune system activation. They mount a response because they're not supposed to be there, which then causes systemic inflammation, which then affects the blood-brain barrier, and that's when inflammation can sit in the brain. So the gut really is the gateway to, you know, protecting us. I mean, 80% of the immune system exists in the gut, and that is really when things start to go wrong in the gut for a number of reasons. That's the domino effect, and then you get in terms of systemic illness and brain issues, also because the gut is connected to the brain via the vagus nerve. Mm-hmm. So if there's an issue in the gut, there's usually going to be another issue in the brain, and vice versa too, actually, from the brain. If the brain's not working well for some reason, that will in turn affect the gut, which then will affect, you know, tight junctions, and it's, you know, just as explained before. So it's all really connected.
Yeah, this so much highlights this holistic approach that we really need to have. Yeah.
Just a couple of things that, if I can, just the first, second question, but first, just this wonderful thing that someone said to remind us about the gut and brain is that the gut, there's a good argument that the gut invented the brain to get itself to food. So they're very, very directly connected. I mean, it's a simplistic way, but it's very true. But the other one is that the term I hear with gut problems, irritable bowel syndrome. Is irritable bowel syndrome and leaky gut the same or similar, or they just cross over? I'm not familiar with what
so, they are. Irritable bowel syndrome is really just a term used in medicine for basically we don't know what's going on with the gut. We call it irritable bowel syndrome because you've got this constellation of symptoms. We haven't identified a pathology as such through a colonoscopy or otherwise. It's a functional disorder. So within irritable bowel syndrome, then you can look, there's different causes for it. So
you might have leaky gut there.
Yeah. Usually there will be leaky gut with irritable bowel syndrome because that can be caused by a parasite or a food intolerance or stress, which will all have an effect on gut lining. So, yes, leaky gut is...
And irritable bowel, it just broadens the people's awareness of what to be affected. Say, oh, he hasn't got leaky gut, but I do have this irritable bowel. So maybe there's a connection there. Again, it's not about firming up. I can see in here, we're not saying because they got this, they got that, you know, because they got that, you know. But with these things, you build up and you get the perfect storm and bang, you go through the sort of things that Matt went through.
Yeah. Basically, if you have any gut issue, any gut symptoms, chances are you'll also have a leaky gut because there's inflammation going on. Something isn't right, or your gut flora isn't right. So, high likelihood that leaky gut is an issue if you have any gastrointestinal symptoms. Yeah.
And you used the term before, integrative medicine, integrative doctor. Did I hear you say that? What sort of doctor is that?
So they're doctors, general practitioners who have done further study in nutrition or herbal medicine. So they've done some of the same subjects that a naturopath will do. So they basically practice as, they integrate both, you know, their orthodox training as a medical doctor, but then they also use modalities like nutrition and herbal medicine as part of their treatment plan.
Oh, I like them. Yeah, good guys.
Yeah, they're good to work with.
Okay, so just to wrap things up here, so we have this incredible connection between the rest of our physiology and our psychology and psychopathology. And what we're advocating is that our psychotherapists who are listening have a good relationship with other health professionals like naturopaths and integrative doctors and others, so that we can get a really good holistic picture of our clients, because OCD isn't necessarily the OCD that we think it is. And many other manifestations, as has been my own personal experience. And so I think it's very important that we're aware that, you know, some of these things can have some very strong neurobiological foundations, and they need to be treated from a physical perspective, not just a psychological perspective.
Absolutely.
So it's a very that thing of that sense of all symptoms are emergent properties of complex events, and similar symptoms can have quite different foundations and forms beneath them. And I'm certainly hearing about that today. Is a OCD, by golly, it could come from trauma when you're young. It could stem from food that you're eating at the time. It can stem from immune system responses. It can stem from neural trauma. There's so many ways, and it can simply stem from things you've been taking, so drugs you've been inducing. So there's so many different type of practitioners. I would love to have a practitioner's office with a circular seat in the middle, and a circular place with a whole bunch of doors, with a whole bunch of practitioners, And clients just come in and they move around all the places from one to the other to build up the picture of their need and their sense of confidence in where they're going, and that every single practitioner in the room gets excited when one of them figures out what it is. That would be the, and I do believe that some of those practices exist. I do know of one, but I know they're not commonplace. I know one in America, but they're not commonplace. And I wish they were, but maybe if we have these conversations more, Matt and Michaela, and other people start to as well, we'll start to understand it. And Matt, for bearing, you know, your private story, which I know, I've seen some of the videos, and Michaela, for you to share the great exploration that you've made, that's beyond just being the student of the basic knowledge. I really admire and want to acknowledge that. It's a beautiful thing. I'm very pleased to have spent this time with you.
Mm.
For those that are interested, we mentioned the Cunningham panel. We have a link on our show notes that will take you to some information about the Cunningham panel. So check that out if you're interested. Also, Michaela's written a great article on our website about Pan's Pandas. I'll point you to that as well. There is a lot to learn. And if you have some knowledge of this, then you will know how to refer your clients and get the help that they need. So I would encourage you to find out about that. And we've got a wealth of information on our site.
Yes. And if anybody's got a case study or they've got particular knowledge of themselves, please send that to us for publication in the Science of Psychotherapy so we can share this and have this in print and have it referenceable. That'd be wonderful.
Absolutely. Michaela, is there any last words you would like to leave us in terms of either PANS or just general practice?
Yeah, I guess for therapists, I think it's important to refer, and when it comes to PANDAS or PANS, early intervention is really important. So better to do it earlier rather than later, because that does have a huge impact on recovery. So the longer you leave it, the longer the recovery period can be. So early intervention is really important. So you know, it's better to be overcautious, I would say, and just if in doubt, just refer earlier rather than later would be my advice. Yeah.
Okay, beautiful. Now, I've just also remembered we've got on our site we do have a link to this documentary, My Kid Is Not Crazy, which is a rather scary but very truthful documentary about Pan's Pandas, and I would encourage you to have a look at that as well.
Yeah, that's a great documentary, yeah.
Yeah, wonderful.
All right, well, thank you so much again, Michaela.
Oh, pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Richard.
And thank you, Matt and Michaela. I've already said my great admiration to both of you.
Thank you, Richard.
Okay, all right, thank you.
Thanks, Matt.
Bye. Well, what a journey. What a journey. I just before the show, I listened to the previous one got myself all emotional again. And then listening to you guys go through this. And if you just get, okay, it's a very distressing problem, but you just get in and you deal with the issues bit by bit, one by one, methodically and thoughtfully, utilizing all the professional knowledge that you can engage with. A hopeful, encouraging, creative story. I loved it. I'm rambling, but thank you, Matt. Thank you.
All right. Well, what I'm hoping is that this will just encourage therapists who are interested in learning more about this, just to go to our website, to go to some of the resources that we have. Check out this really well-made documentary, My Kid Is Not Crazy, that will forever burn this particular psychopathology into your brain.
It can be
quite disturbing. And learn as much as you can about this sort of thing. It's not something that you will deal with directly as a psychotherapist. You will put your clients in the hands of other medical professionals who know how to treat this. But you will be doing the best by your clients if you are aware. Yes. Thanks, Richard, for joining in the conversation.
It was my great good fortune, and thanks to you, and thanks to Michaela. And this is me saying we'll see you next week. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us here on the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. We'll catch you next week.
Thanks for listening to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. For more great science, go to thescienceofpsychotherapy.com.